and minorities from persecution, in particular victims of sexual violence. I lived my childhood as a village girl in Kojo, south of Sinjar region. I did not know anything about the Nobel Peace Prize. I knew nothing about the conflicts and killings that took place in our world every day. I did not know that human beings could perpetrate such hideous crimes against each other. As a young girl, I dreamed of finishing high school. It was my dream to have a beauty parlor in our village and to live near my family in Sinjar. But this dream became a nightmare. Unexpected things happened. Genocide took place. As a consequence, I lost my mother, six of my brothers, and my brother's children. Every Yazidi family has a similar story, one more horrible than the other because of this genocide. In the 21st century, in the age of globalization and human rights, more than 6,500 Yazidi children and women became captive and were sold, bought, and sexually and psychologically abused. Despite our daily appeals since 2014, the fate of more than 3,000 children and women in the grip of ISIS is still unknown. Young girls at the prime of life are sold, bought, held captive, and raped every day. It is inconceivable that the conscience of the leaders of 195 countries around the world is not mobilized to liberate these girls. What if they were a commercial deal? An oil field or a shipment of weapons. Most certainly, no efforts would be spared to liberate them. Every day, I hear tragic stories. Hundreds of thousands and even millions of children and women around the world are suffering from persecution and violence. Every day, I hear the screams of children in Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Every day, we see hundreds of women and children in Africa and other countries becoming murder projects fuel for wars without anyone moving in to help them or hold to account those who commit these crimes. For almost 4 years, I've been traveling around the world to tell my story and that of my community and other vulnerable communities without having achieved any justice. The perpetrators of sexual violence against Yazidis and other women and girls are yet to be prosecuted for these crimes. If justice is not done, this genocide will be repeated against us and against other vulnerable communities. Justice is the only way to achieve peace and coexistence among the various components of Iraq. If we do not want to repeat cases of rape and captivity against women, we must hold to account those who have used sexual violence as a weapon to commit crimes against women and girls. Thank you very much for this honor, but the fact remains that the only prize in the world that can restore our dignity is justice and the prosecution of criminals. There is no award. There is no award that can compensate for our people and our loved ones who were killed solely because they were Yazidis. The only prize that will restore a normal life between our people and our friends is justice and protection for the rest of this community.
That was Nadia Murad receiving the 2018 Nobel Peace Prize on International Human Rights Day, December 10th, 2018, just a few weeks ago in Oslo, Norway. I want to thank Alexandra Bombach, the award-winning filmmaker, cinematographer, director of On Her Shoulders, which profiles the life of Nadia Murad. It is playing in select theaters from New York to Los Angeles and also available at, among other places, Amazon Prime. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadur, Tamari Astudio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vestica Dars, and Carl Marxer. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Meadows, Anna Uzbek, and Matt Ely. You can see and listen to our shows at democracynow.org on video and audio podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
Attention, KABU supporters. We apologize for the nonsensical on-air acknowledgments that have aired after recent membership drives. We assure you that those responsible have been dealt with appropriately, and the spot they conceived for this promo will never air. Please enjoy this message instead.
On behalf of the entire KABU community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KABU's Give Guide campaign. Your support makes KABU possible. Thank you!
Ah, free of complexity, controversy, and most importantly, hawk screeches.
Support KABU, where music makes the movement.
The time is 5:07. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU listener members and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland. Offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch, Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up in the KABU Evening News, an Indian American woman makes history as she takes her new office in Multnomah County.
A series of earthquakes hits near Mount St. Helens, and some people in Portland say they could feel the shaking.
And some Portland students speak out about the idea of putting police officers in their schools.
And in international news, the Honduran election brings unease because of concern about voter fraud. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. I'm Rachel Hartley.
And I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. Now, if you thought you felt a rumble beneath your feet in the early morning hours today, you weren't dreaming. Here with more is KBOO's Ollie Mintz Lowell.
A magnitude 3.9 earthquake struck near Mount St. Helens this morning, one of 40 to hit the region since New Year's Day. This morning's quake was felt in parts of Portland and Vancouver at 12:36 a.m., followed by a smaller 2.7 quake 3 minutes later. Mount St. Helens, which stands 50 miles from Portland and 96 miles from Seattle, is still considered an active volcano. According to the United States Geological Society, today's 3.9 earthquake was a result of regional as opposed to local stress, meaning they don't believe it's related to the nearby volcano. Although some of the recent activity does appear to be from Mount St. Helens itself, this is a result of an active volcanic system and movement along regional stress lines and not a sign of an impending eruption. There have been no reported injuries from any of the earthquakes. This is Ollie Mintzlow for KBOO News.
Portland's branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People is jumping into a fight about the city's earthquake warning signs. According to the Oregonian, the NAACP links the placards to a legacy of white supremacy. The city's policy will require owners of brick buildings to post public warnings that the buildings could collapse in earthquakes. The civil rights group says it will hold a rally Saturday at City Hall, urging the city to drop the ordinance, which would impact about 1,600 buildings. The city council approved the policy in October. Leaders of predominantly black churches say they were left out of the talks while the ordinance was being written.
So Sheila Jayapal was sworn in today as a Multnomah County Commissioner. Now this means she is the very first Indian American to hold an elected office in a county in our state. She left India at the age of 16 to go to college here in the U.S. Oregon Live reports that she told a large crowd gathered at the ceremony that she never planned to run for office, but felt, quote, a sense of urgency about the fact that the region has become unlivable for too many people. She says our economy has been booming, and we all know the adage that says a rising tide lifts all boats, and you all know very well that's simply not true, end of quote. Jayapal will represent North and Northeast Portland. She ran on a platform of fighting gentrification and homelessness, focusing on mental health and addiction treatment and restorative justice programs in each school. She is a longtime leader of nonprofit and community groups. She won the seat previously won by Loretta Smith, who is required to step down after serving two terms. With Jayapal's election, the county commission is all female and the most diverse in the state, with a Mexican-American member, Jessica Vega Peterson, and a Korean-born one, Lori Stegman. Jayapal's younger sister, Pramila, represents the Seattle area in Congress.
Oregon lawmakers could end single-family zoning when they go back to the state capitol in Salem this month. Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek is drafting legislation that requires cities with more than 10,000 residents to allow as many as four homes on properties. The Public News Service's Eric Tegedoff has more.
In an effort to tackle the affordable housing crisis, Oregon could end single-family zoning this legislative session. Oregon would be the first state to do so if lawmakers who support the idea succeed. Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek is drafting legislation that requires cities with more than 10,000 residents to allow up to four homes to be built on parcels currently zoned exclusively for single-family housing, according to Willamette Week reporters. Mary Kyle McCurdy is deputy director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, a watchdog group for Oregon's land use planning program. She says such a proposal could meet the needs of more Oregon families in the places where affordability is an issue.
In areas that are largely already developed, those also tend to be the ones that have their infrastructure, they're near schools and parks, there may be transit. Those are the areas where we should be providing more housing options so that people can more readily get to school, their jobs, the store.
McCurdy notes that Oregon is short about 155,000 housing units statewide, according to various studies, and most of that is housing for middle and lower income Oregonians. In December, Minneapolis became the first major city to eliminate single-family zoning. Portland is considering a similar plan. The city has the fourth highest percentage of single-family home occupancy in the nation. McCurdy says zoning practices have historically been used as tools for segregation, and a plan to address single-family zoning could also deal with this issue. She says creating more diverse housing options within cities also prevents sprawl.
It's much more expensive to provide roads and pipes to new areas that aren't developed at all, and that makes the housing that might be built there pretty unaffordable. And it also is usually not located near to transit or existing schools and parks and that sort of thing, and it causes people to have to drive more.
Oregon lawmakers head to Salem on January 22nd. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A group of Portland students held a big announcement. They wanted to tell everyone how they feel about a proposal to put police officers in their schools. Here's what they said in their words.
Officer is an armed police officer who is stationed to work in schools. On December 11, 2018, PPS School Board voted to approve a five-year, $6 million contract with the Portland Police Bureau, which will increase armed police presence in schools 5 days a week and take out of the school budget. We as PPS students are extremely disappointed in the school board's actions and believe that police do not have a place in our schools. Although Portland Police claims to use referrals to the juvenile justice system as a last resort, the implementation of SROs will inevitably increase the likelihood of students entering the justice system. According to the ACLU, during the 2013-2014 school year, there were 223,000 referrals to law enforcement in schools nationwide, most often for interference with educational facilities. Students have been charged with disorderly conduct, for kicking a trash can, arguing, refusing to leave the lunchroom, and countless other mild misbehaviors. While this agreement claims to avoid such incidents, there is always the possibility of misconduct by the school or police. This possibility is simply too big of a risk when we are talking about students potentially entering the criminal justice system. Additionally, SROs further contribute to discrimination in schools. Black students are more than twice as likely than white peers to be referred to law enforcement, usually for objective behaviors such as disrespect. Referrals to police are also discriminatory towards students with disabilities, who make up 20% of law enforcement referrals. And what about the undocumented schools in our city who go to classrooms thinking they are in a sanctuary space? How are they supposed to react when they see an armed police officer in schools? These practices undermine the creation of safe and respectful school environments for students who are trying to prioritize learning. Having armed police officers in school can lead to a hostile and unsafe environment for some students. With at least two fatal shootings by Portland police in the past 7 months, those of Jason Washington and Patrick Kimmons, as well as a man dying in police custody on November 22nd, Portland police have proven to pose threats of danger, particularly towards people of color and people with disabilities. Stationing police officers in schools will further contribute to an environment of fear and distrust. Still, the Portland Police Bureau claims that SROs are trauma-informed. Yet their very existence is contradictory. Police are a massive trigger, especially to the aforementioned groups. In order for students to be fully engaged in school, it is crucial that they feel safe. SROs threaten the education of PPS students of all ages, as children cannot be expected to learn effectively in fear or anxiety. Furthermore, there is nothing outlined in the agreement that illustrates the necessities of SROs in schools. If student referrals to the justice system are the last resort, what are SROs providing that school staff are unable to? The argument that officers stationed in schools protect against potential intrusion is one based in paranoia. The actual threat of an outside intruder is relatively minor, and the likelihood of the SROs preventing violence is even slimmer. If an emergency were to occur and police presence was absolutely necessary, they are always just a simple three-digit phone call away. None of this was taken into account by the school board before the vote. The board put very little effort into gaining student input on the agreement, and the student voices that were heard were blatantly ignored, along with the voices of parents, teachers, and the ACLU. On the night of the vote, student after student expressed their concerns from different schools, across PBS, asking for a delay in the vote to ensure adequate community feedback. The board made it clear that they had no interest in listening to students, and they repeatedly dismissed valid concerns even after hearing a parent-made petition to delay the vote. The petition that was made received over 700 signatures within the last 24 hours. As a community, we were able to engage more of our community feedback than PBS was able to since this agreement has been on the table. The petition has since received nearly 300 more. Furthermore, the board went as far as cutting students' microphones off while testimony, and they were gaveled away. Millions of dollars in question could be used towards repairing our schools, as many are still lead and asbestos contaminated. The money could go towards trauma-informed school counselors and training staff and restorative justice. For the past 3 weeks, we've been organizing and resisting, and we will not quit until SROs are taken out of schools. We are here to show the PBS board that we know our voices were ignored, but now we are determined to be heard. We demand that SROs are taken out of schools. We are here today because City Council must now approve of the agreement for it to go through. We urge City Council to vote no on the agreement and to work with students and staff to implement alternative solutions to the question of student safety. As citizens of the City of Portland, we urge you to look to your elected officials and ask them what they're doing to make our kids feel safe in the classrooms.
And you were listening to the words of some Portland students. They were holding a press conference to tell the community how they feel about the plan to put public police officers in Portland's public schools.
A suspect is in the Multnomah County Jail after an officer-involved shooting investigation. Officers arrested 34-year-old Anita Ruiz during a domestic violence disturbance that resulted in the shooting on January 2nd. Ruiz faces charges of menacing and unlawful use of a weapon. Portland Police, the Multnomah County District Attorney, and Portland's Independent Police Review Board are investigating this officer-involved shooting. Detectives believe shortly after the officers responded to a domestic disturbance in the Stacy Lee Apartments on Northeast 147th Avenue, they contacted several people involved in the disturbance. Officers say Ruiz got a knife and charged at officers. An officer fired one round, Ruiz was not injured, and was then arrested. No one was hurt.
The legal troubles of the militia members who took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge in Oregon in 2016 continue. The federal judge overseeing the case has moved up the date that one of the militia members must report to prison. Judge Anna Brown, who is based in Portland, was angry when she saw photos of two of the conspirators posted on Facebook in late December. The photos showed the convicted men visiting the Bundy Ranch in Nevada after they had been ordered to have no contact with any other named defendant in the case. As a result, John Ritzheimer, who pleaded guilty last year to federal conspiracy charges, must surrender himself to federal custody on January 12th instead of the original date of February 15th.
Multnomah County's district attorney announced the indictment of 25-year-old Rachel Banks for manslaughter, driving while under the influence, and reckless driving. Court documents accuse Banks of killing another person while driving under the influence on December 18th. It happened on I-205 just north of the Stark Street overpass in Portland. Witnesses say her car was in the center lane and that Banks lost control. She crashed into large construction barrels and slid into two construction trucks, according to court documents. The crash resulted in her passenger, 21-year-old Calvin Biltimore, being pinned inside the vehicle. Portland Fire and Rescue removed the roof of the vehicle to pull Biltimore out. He died on December 25th in a hospital. Portland police found that Banks was high on some sort of narcotic. Her next court date is on February 19th.
A woman seen threatening a black couple on Christmas Eve in McMinnville has been indicted now on several felony and misdemeanor charges. A video shows 39-year-old Amber Rocco shouting racist insults at the couple while holding a knife. According to court records, Rocco has been charged with a total of 10 criminal counts, including unlawful use of a weapon, fourth-degree assault, second-degree intimidation and menacing, and harassment charges.
A Portland man has been sentenced to prison in order to pay $23,000 for posing as a doctor and claiming to have a dying child. 36-year-old Mitchell Boki pleaded guilty in Multnomah Circuit Court to theft by deception. Judge Kathleen Daly ordered Bokocci to spend a year in prison and pay the fine. Detectives learned that a woman gave Bokocci a cashier's check for $23,000 under the pretense that he would use the money to pay for chemotherapy, claiming his daughter was sick with leukemia. He presented himself as a doctor and as a single parent. The investigation started in 2017 when the victim reported to police that in 2014 she was at a park in Portland with her daughter when she started a conversation with Bokocci in German. Bokocci called her and said he needed to meet with her for an urgent matter. He asked her for a quick loan to cover the medical expenses for his daughter, who he claimed was dying.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Thanks so much for joining us here. Stay tuned after this newscast. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, join us for Urban Funk. And then coming up at 8 tonight, listen to Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather. We can expect some rain tonight, down to a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow, some showers in the morning, all the way up to a high of 41. And over the weekend, we're looking at light rain on Saturday, a little heavier rain on Sunday. Highs in the mid-40s both days and lows near 40. Today in history, in 1990, Panama's General Manuel Noriega surrendered to American troops to face charges of drug trafficking. He'd been holed up for 10 days before that happened. Our quote of the day is from a new Multnomah County Commissioner, Shashila Jayapal, who was sworn in as the very first Indian American on the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners today. She says her District 2 and North and Northeast Portland, quote, has borne the effects of a booming economy resulting in construction of expensive condos, boutiques, and restaurants, and soaring real estate values, and also resulting in the displacement of those left out of the economy and in the ripping apart of long-established and closely knit communities.
At Kingsley Field in Oregon, the 173rd Fighter Wing will welcome home a team of 15 airmen from a six-month deployment to Iraq tomorrow. A demobilization ceremony is scheduled for 10 a.m. at the base. They are assigned to the 270th Air Traffic Control Squadron, the unit responsible for the air traffic control services at Kingsley Field. During this deployment, they provided radar approach and finals control at the busiest airfield in Iraq, Al-Assad Air Base. Captain Alex Fugat said, and quote, every one of these folks was a volunteer. When you go back to our roots as the guard and the militia, it's that same spirit of volunteerism that you see. All of these people wanted to be there. He was in charge of the deployed group.
Portland's Fire Chief Mike Myers announced today that he is stepping down from the job. Myers started at Portland Fire and Rescue back in 2016 and joined with the promise of bringing modern business practices there. His accomplishments in his 2.5 years as chief include technology advancements in communication, GPS for responding vehicles, and software enhancements for training in emergencies. He hired the Bureau's first equity manager and made a complete revision to employee discipline. Chief Myers also made firefighter safety a top priority. His Blueprint for Success project has led fire stations to start looking at the specific threats to safety and reasons for 911 calls within their areas and consider how they can help provide long-term solutions and prevention. Myers says, quote, I thank the employees of Portland Fire and Rescue for their hard work and support during my time here. This is a personal decision on my part. I love the coast, and my wife has already moved there, and it is my strong desire to join her. I have every faith that the leadership of Portland Fire and Rescue will continue to serve the city of Portland at the highest level. My only regret is that I was very excited to work with Commissioner Joanne Hardesty and her team. Commissioner Hardesty says she is sad to lose his leadership and friendship. She says, quote, "His vision for a vibrant city was exactly what we need, and I am disappointed to not work on his plan together." The city has not chosen a new chief or an interim chief yet.
Two Native women are joining this Congress, and Kiowa elders help teach their Native language. Now, it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Newly elected U.S. lawmakers are prepared to take the oath of office, including Deb Holland and Sharice Davids, the first Native American women to serve in Congress. Holland, whose Laguna Pueblo is hosting an open house at her congressional office. She joined family, friends, and supporters on Wednesday, expressing gratitude in this video by Indians.com.
As a Pueblo woman, I know the importance of food, preparing food and cooking food. It's not just because you want to feed people who are hungry. It's the nourishment of your soul and your heart and all of those things. So I just appreciate so much all of the hard work that all of you did today. So thank you so much. It means the world to me.
Sharice Davids, whose Ho-Chunk was on MSNBC Thursday morning, David says she'll educate members of Congress alongside Holland on Native issues, highlighting history and modern-day experiences of Native communities.
I think that there are not enough people who understand this area, who understand Native communities and, frankly, the federal tribal government-to-government relationship that exists. But this, even just the fact that you're asking me about this right now, is evidence that we are going to see a new era of information, of people understanding, and hopefully of change.
Members of the Native community are planning to celebrate their swearing-in. Janie Parrish, a specialist in tribal digital and social media, is taking part in events in D.C.
There's a reception being held by a collective group, and they're going to be doing an honoring and a celebration at the Hyatt Regency this evening. And that's what I understand is really open to the public. It's to celebrate Sharice and Deb for their swearing-in today.
Parrish says there's excitement by Native people not only in the D.C. area, but she's seeing social media posts from across Indian country.
Well, I know a lot of folks are sharing photos, whether it's personal photos with Sharice or Deb, but they're also sharing articles about them. I'm seeing people take photos of them with their interviews on MSNBC and CNN, and so we actually see Native women on mainstream networks, and everyone's excited about that. So that's what I'm seeing, is just a lot of people sharing from their homes or wherever they're at, wanting to be a part of it somehow, and seeing themselves represented is really important.
The swearing-in of the new Congress takes place Thursday afternoon. The Kiowa tribe is making its language and traditions available online. As Claire Donnelly reports, it's part of language preservation efforts.
KiowaTalk.org has more than 100 videos of Dorothy Whitehorse DeLon pronouncing Kiowa vocabulary words and phrases.
I'm so happy I'm a Kiowa woman.
She also sings songs and shares stories. Whitehorse DeLon is a Kiowa elder. She's 86 years old.
I was always interested in who I was, where I came from. I speak Kiowa fluently on account of my parents. My dad didn't speak a word of English. I regretted it because I never exposed my children to it. They just know the basics.
She and other elders created the website to make the tribe's language and oral traditions accessible to younger generations. The Kiowa tribe is headquartered in southwestern Oklahoma. I'm Claire Donnelly.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A noted conservative activist, Steve Bannon, is attacking his former boss and accusing President Trump of treason through collusion with the Russian government. At the same time, another aspect of Robert Mueller's investigation of the Trump administration has documented extensive collusion between Donald Trump's campaign officials and Russia. The founders of the company Fusion GPS say that the FBI and congressional committees received credible allegations about a Kremlin conspiracy throughout the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign. They say the FBI had this information well before the Mueller investigation began.
No progress after a bipartisan meeting with Trump on the border shutdown. Also, on the Thursday rundown, the government shutdown is stalling food stamp work requirements and a look at why Americans are living shorter lives. Here's more from Mike Clifford with the Public News Service.
Congressional Democratic leaders emerged from a White House meeting with President Trump and their GOP counterparts with not much new to report about ending the government shutdown. Talking Points memo reports it is making it clear that neither side has budged over Trump's demands that they give him $5 billion for a wall. Instead, TPM reports Democratic leaders reiterated their promise to support a bill funding most of the government through September while punting funding for the Department of Homeland Security, the exact proposal that the Senate had passed in December unanimously before Trump pulled an about-face and forced a partial shutdown that's now in day 13. TPM reports the House is expected to pass that plan shortly after Democrats take control of the lower chamber when the new Congress is gaveled in today. And tomorrow's the last chance to speak out on a controversial land deal in which the Bureau of Land Management wants to sell some sensitive land to a company that's accused of polluting it.
An international mining conglomerate called Omya was cited in 2011 for dumping waste rock from its calcium carbonate mine on a 70-acre parcel in the desert near the San Bernardino National Forest in Lucerne Valley. Nada Culver with the Wilderness Society says the land has been designated an area of critical environmental concern, something that would have to be changed for the deal to go through.
To actually take the radical step of amending a land use plan to take away that special designation, that in and of itself is a radical step, but to sell the land, sell the mineral rights to a company that trespassed on this land. We would characterize it as not just a run-of-the-mill bad idea, but in fact a spectacularly bad idea.
The land is part of the California Desert Conservation Area and is considered an important wintering area for mule deer. It's also part of a narrow corridor of public land used by bighorn sheep and the golden eagle and contains a rare desert spring that supports many species of wildlife and plants. In the draft plan, the BLM justifies the sale by noting that the mine supports 50 jobs and has contributed $800,000 in tax revenue. Culver says the deal would go against the BLM's core mission.
These are not things to be taken lightly. You know, the BLM is obligated to protect these types of areas. The BLM is obligated to keep public lands in public hands. It's actually their obligation under their own laws.
The public comment period ends tomorrow on the BLM's e-planning site. The Sierra Club is also circulating a petition opposing the deal. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
It is no longer a secret that Americans are dying at an alarming rate related to a nationwide opioid crisis and increased suicide. But those factors are also contributing to reduction in life expectancy.
Late last year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported a sustained 3-year drop in life expectancy not seen since 1918, when it was attributed to deaths from World War I and a flu pandemic. Population health researcher Steven Bezruchka says life expectancy is on the rise around the globe, but not in the United States. He says there are now 35 countries where people live longer lives.
So people's lives are not what they expect to have. And the fact that mortality in adulthood, that is the 25 to 64 year range, the prime of life, that's going up. And people are internalizing the stress of life, and stress kills.
The CDC's preliminary figures showed that 72,000 people in the U.S. died from drug overdoses in 2017, nearly 200 a day. The number of suicides nationwide was 47,000, the highest in a half century. In the past 5 decades, the gap between the rich and poor has risen significantly in the U.S., and Bezruchka notes that societies with high levels of economic inequality typically have lower life expectancy rates. I'm Roz Brown.
In addition to Japan, women live the longest in Spain and Switzerland, while men live longer in Switzerland, Australia, and Japan. Finally, Mark Richardson reports that Arizona cotton farmers, who may shortly be looking for crops that use less water, could be cultivating hemp.
The hemp plant is a relative of marijuana, and both Arizona and the federal government passed new laws recently allowing the commercial growing, interstate sale, and processing of the now legal weed. Hemp is used to manufacture clothes, shoes, and ropes, as well as biofuels, medicines, and more. Chelsea McGuire with the Arizona Farm Bureau says hemp, unlike its hallucinogenic cousin, contains almost none of the chemical THC, which produces the high in marijuana.
If the level of THC, which is the mind-altering chemical in marijuana, if that's higher than 0.03, then it's not hemp, it's marijuana. If it's lower than that, then it's hemp. So that's how you tell the difference between the two.
State agricultural officials say that due to a decade of drought, Arizona farmers' annual water allotments could be reduced, making it harder to grow crops such as cotton. McGuire says hemp uses about one-third of the amount of water it takes to grow cotton, and a short cultivation cycle would allow most farms two or more crops per year. She says pending final regulatory approval, the first Arizona hemp crop will likely go in the ground in May.
Medical use of marijuana is legal in the state of Arizona, but recreational use is still banned. Hemp growers will be licensed and regulated by state officials who plan to test crops frequently for their THC content. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for News and Cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported.
The U.S. supported contested election a month ago that many Hondurans are calling a coup. Government troops have killed more than 30 protesters. This week, the Catholic Church weighed in on the issue, saying they have received threats against several priests involved in grassroots organizing in Honduras. Church leaders say that the threats against their priests are an attempt to create terror in the people as a strategy to demobilize them. The November 26th Honduran elections returned John Orlando Hernandez to power, but only after a lengthy vote counting process marred with unexplained delays and unexplained technical difficulties. He also overcame a large lead held from opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla, who was ahead with a majority of votes counted before a long suspension of the count by the country's electoral tribunal in Honduras. Despite documented fraud in that election, the United States certified the results on December 22nd.
Workers at Amazon's largest warehouse in Spain started a two-day strike today to push for better working conditions and pay. The action was called for by Spain's two largest unions, CCOO and UGT, to coincide with a major gift-giving holiday. Amazon worker David Matarez told Reuters, and quote, "This is the richest company in the world, and they want to keep profiting by taking away workers' rights."
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for this Thursday, January 3rd, 2019. Here are some of the main points again. An Indian-American woman makes history as she takes office in Multnomah County. Oregon's elected leaders may also make history if they end single-family housing zoning in the state, as they plan to do starting later this month. And Portland students speak out about the idea of bringing police into their schools. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories. Here's the number to call the tips into, 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Ollie Minslow, Annette Newell, and Rachel Hartley. The producers are Rachel Hartley and Annette Newell, and our engineers are Mike Fataklis and Ollie Minslow. The director of evening news and public affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.
And I'm Rachel Hartley. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, I'm Positively Revolting. Ani takes your calls. At 9, Pacific Underground, a show for and by the Asian and Pacific Islander communities in the Northwest. At 10, Valley Views looks at how the two-party political system thrives while freedom of choice dies. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, a Radio Geekly investigates video games' effects on their forms of media, both positively and negatively. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
So difficult to give up, tied to it by small things, my eyes noting movement, color and form. I am watching, unable to leave, for something is happening, and so I stand in a shower of rain or under a hot sun, worn out with looking. Thank you.
Thank you. The time is 6 o'clock. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Judge Torres, running January 10th to 19th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Judge Torres is a modern-day fairy tale rooted in Salvadoran